Hello, friends. Welcome back to Love Will Tear Us Apart, a podcast on your favorite complicated couples. In this episode, I want to explore the relationship of Michael Hutchence and Paula Yates. These two were not on my shortlist, but after watching the Michael Hutchence documentary Mystify, I thought this couple would be worthy of an episode because, oh my god, their relationship was batshit crazy. I also thought this episode would be quick to research and write, but holy crap, was I wrong. It's taken me weeks, probably months at this point, to research and write this episode because I wanted it to be perfect. Their story has so many moving parts, and Michael, Paula, and Bob Geldof all have their respective fan bases, so I wanted to do their story justice. Until I watched the documentary, I had been a casual fan of INXS. I was too young to enjoy their heyday in the late 80s and early 90s, and by the late 90s, when their music videos were rerunning on VH1, I was still too young to enjoy the quality of their music and Michael Hutchence's tight pants. So, total side note, in my pubescent years, I had a crush on 1970s Elton John and Christopher Lloyd's Doc Brown in Back to the Future. So, you kind of can tell where my mind was at when Michael Hutchence was popular. So the zeitgeist of INXS had passed by me, obviously, and by the time I was an adult, I enjoyed the sporadic listen of INXS on a CD or maybe on Spotify. Watching Mystify, which is directed by Richard Lowenstein, a friend and music video director for the band, showed me how much I was missing out on. After watching the film, I dove into INXS's library and realized what incredible songwriters they were, particularly once I listened to their earlier stuff. What the documentary also did was make me actually cry for a man I never knew or particularly cared for. It's evident that the filmmaker and Michael's friends, family, and lovers who were interviewed had a deep love and respect for the flawed man. It is truly tragic that Michael Hutchence ended his life at the young age of 37, and the documentary leaves you feeling that his death was completely avoidable. If you haven't seen the documentary yet, I highly recommend it. It's not a perfect film. It's sort of non-linear and a little confusing at times. And it also feels a little propagandic in that it only lightly brushes upon Michael's negative traits. But by the end, your heart breaks. Lowenstein includes a lot of personal and unreleased footage, which gives you an intimate view of the late singer. From all accounts, Michael was a kind, playful, and deeply passionate person that others enjoyed being around. The documentary also reveals that the Michael everyone knew and loved dramatically changed by the early 1990s, and I'll save the reasons why for the podcast. Even though I didn't know much about Michael before I did my podcast research, over the years I've gone down the rabbit hole of rag mags that sensationalized his relationship with Paula Yates. How could you not? The press hounded the couple for years, particularly in England, and their love story continues to fascinate people to this day. The Hutchence-Yates relationship is truly an epic tragedy. And while Paula was painted as the villain in the story, as well as her ex-husband Bob Geldof, I've come to realize that this complicated love triangle was much more nuanced than what the press portrayed it as. I wanted to make sure that everyone got a fair shake in this episode. And just a little side note, this episode talks about suicide, depression, and drug abuse. If you or anyone you know is experiencing thoughts of suicide, please call the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline at 1-800-273-8255. So without further ado, here's the heartbreaking love story of Michael Hutchence and Paula Yates. Michael Hutchence was born in Sydney, Australia on January 22, 1960. According to his half-sister Tina, who helped raise him and authored two books on her brother, Michael was a very happy, smiley, and outgoing child. "I was a good boy," he said to Polly Yates in the famous interview before they went public with their relationship. Michael, along with his sister and his younger brother Rhett, bounced around the Pacific Rim due to their father's work. Their father, Kel, was a businessman whose various jobs often came with wealth, chauffeurs, and caretakers, and their mother, Patricia, was a model and makeup artist. The family spent a short stint in Hong Kong and also lived all over Australia. When Michael's parents split up in his teenage years, he and his mother and his sister moved to Los Angeles for a short period of time. In biographies, it is believed that all of this moving around made Michael quite a nomadic soul, who later had difficulty staying in relationships. Michael returned to Australia a year later and reunited with his friend and classmate Andrew Ferris. The two would soon form a band called the Ferris Brothers, alongside Andrew's brothers Tim and John, and their friends Gary Beers and Kirk Pengilly. It was while they were opening for the sweet-ass Australian rock band Midnight Oil that they came up with their forever name. Inspired by the British band XTC and the Australian band IXL, INXS was born. This band of highly motivated and attractive teenagers began to take off right as the disco era was ending and the dawn of the 80s was upon them. In the early days of INXS, Michael had two notable girlfriends, Amanda Braxton Smith, who introduced him to classical literature, and Michelle Bennett. Unlike Michael's future girlfriends, Michelle wasn't famous at the time. But like his future girlfriends, Michelle was absolutely stunning. About their first meeting, this is what she said. "He just eyeballed me. When he focuses on you, it's hard to ignore. It draws you in and draws things out. I've never experienced anything like it. He was just very different from anyone I had ever met. It swept me off my feet." They worked together for 5 years from 1982 to 1987, and from many accounts, this was a very happy period in Michael's life. Both Richard Lowenstein and Tina Hutchins consider Michelle possibly Michael's greatest love. The two bought a house together and were even engaged. However, their relationship couldn't handle the demands of INXS's meteoric rise. They broke up and got back together again multiple times. But finally, they realized their relationship could not continue. Michael was the one who ended it, and they were both devastated. The end of their relationship coincided with one of INXS's career highlights, the release of their sixth studio album, Kick, which featured the iconic ballad, Never Tear Us Apart. This song was written for Michelle before their breakup, and it shows just how connected the two were. Okay, I'm going to sing a little bit because I don't have rights to the music, so I'm going to try and sing. Don't judge me. "I was standing, you were there. Two worlds colliding, and they could never tear us apart." So ironically, even though the two would never date again, Michelle was the last person Michael called and wanted to see before he ended his life. The album Kick put INXS into a whole new orbit of fame. Pretty much every track on that record was a hit, from New Sensation to Devil Inside to Need You Tonight, and every girl wanted to get into Michael's pants. With his waifish body, long curls over his beautiful face, and wiggly, Jagger-like dancing, Michael was the it rocker of the late 1980s. The album made it to number 3 in America and went platinum 6 times over. During the Kick release and tour, Michael dated model Rosanna Crash and then moved on to Australia's favorite girl next door, Kylie Minogue. It was quite the scandal when the almost 30-year-old In Excess singer, who oozed sex and naughtiness, began dating the 22-year-old prim and proper Aussie sweetheart. One of the first things he reportedly said to her was, "I don't know what we should do first, have lunch or have sex." In the documentary Mystify, Kylie said this about their relationship. "Sex, love, food, drugs, music, travel, books, you name it, he wanted to experience it. As his partner, I got to experience a lot of that as well. I felt very safe with him. I felt protected. If you're a sensual being, all of your senses need stimulation. He definitely awakened my desire for things in my world. He loved seeing me experiencing. He had an insatiable curiosity. All the good things in life and some of the bad things in life. It opened up a whole new world for me. It really did. A lot of it was based around pleasure, let's face it." So there's even this rumor that they had sex in first class on a plane and that the Australian Prime Minister saw them. Kylie had been mostly tight-lipped about her relationship with Michael until the Mystify documentary. She shared with the director a trove of pictures and videos of their relationship. Some of the videos are quite sensual, and it's apparent that the two had a close bond. Kylie even kept all of the faxes Michael had sent her while they traveled. She says it was a magical time in her life. Michael had helped her become a woman and learn more about the world. But just like Michelle, the demands of their schedules meant they didn't see each other very often. The two would only be together for 2 years, from 1989 to 1991, and even when they broke up, there was still love there. Recalling when their relationship came to an end, Kylie said, "He was on all fours on the floor crying. I didn't know what to do. I didn't know what was happening. Where have you gone? I don't know if it was associated with any guilt of having to break my heart and what I'd go through after that. Was it work? Was it drugs? I don't know. I just know he was a broken man. I'd never seen any man like that before. It was like he was cocooning himself, rolling into a little ball in there. It was, yeah, I left pretty confounded and destroyed, and I knew that was it. Yeah, he broke my heart. I have to confess, the hurt stays for quite a long time. I think I realized in that time, this was beyond me. This was a bigger story." Michael was not one to stay single for very long. In fact, he most likely left Kylie for his next girlfriend, the 23-year-old supermodel Helena Christensen. At the time, Helena was known for her steamy canoodling in Chris Isaak's Wicked Game music video, and for being part of the circle of models that included Cindy Crawford, Naomi Campbell, Claudia Schiffer, Elle McPherson, Christy Turlington, and Linda Evangelista. Though he loved the ladies, Michael loved being in love. This is what Helena said. "He loved women, but he was very committed when he was with somebody. Very homey, really. He just wanted to nest." Side note, there are very conflicting reports on whether Michael was very committed when he was in a relationship. Emotionally, yes. Physically, maybe not. So the couple split their time between Helena's Paris apartment and Michael's Southern France retreat, where they spent their free time with friends and family. This, too, was a happy period in Michael's life, until one fateful summer night in 1992. Helena and Michael were riding bikes through her native Copenhagen and stopped to eat pizza. Michael was blocking the path of a taxi cab, and the driver got out of the car and attacked Michael. Michael fell backwards and hit his head so hard that he began bleeding out of his nose and ears. Helena thought he was dead. He was taken to the hospital, but he refused treatment. This decision would have detrimental effects for the rest of his life. Michael spent weeks holed up in Helena's apartment, throwing up and angry. When the horrible side effects didn't subside, he finally got an MRI. This is when he and Helena discovered that he had fractured his skull and his brain had been damaged. He permanently lost his sense of smell and taste, something that was devastating to the ultra-sensual Michael. Many friends and family in Michael's circle believe this traumatic brain injury led to Michael's complete unravel over the next 5 years until his death. With his new depression and mood swings, Helena, who was young and ambitious, didn't know how to handle this new man. She began shutting him out, she said. Until the documentary, Helena had never spoken about the night Michael hit his head. He made her swear that she would never tell anyone about the severity of the injury. When Michael met up with his INXS bandmates to write their 9th album, Full Moon, Dirty Hearts, at the end of 1992, he smashed Andrew's guitar and pulled a knife on Gary. People close to Michael were confused because they knew it wasn't him. His mood changed from day to day, and he became more obsessive and violent. He also fell more into hard drugs and dangerous behavior. There are various beliefs of when Michael began seeing Paula Yates, the charming and beautiful British TV show presenter and wife of Bob Geldof. But before we get into their relationship, a little backstory on the charismatic Paula Yates. Paula Yates was born on April 24, 1959, to actress mother Elena Smith and a much older TV show presenter father, Jess Yates, who really wasn't her father. This was something she wouldn't discover until years later. Jess left the family when Paula was 8, and the mom-daughter duo bounced around Europe. Paula described her childhood as lonely and absent of attention from her mother and father. She started going to clubs in her early teens, where she experimented with sex and heroin. She never finished high school. 17-year-old Paula met 25-year-old Bob Geldof, her future husband, at a party in Ireland, Geldof's home country. She followed him and his band, the Boomtown Rats, around Europe, and the pair quickly began a relationship. When you look at early pictures of the couple, they look happy. Bob was stabilizing for Paula, and she soon became a teetotaler. They were an incredibly hip couple, and their personalities seemed to gel. They both wore wacky clothing and hairstyles, and were photographed in close embraces. The 80s would prove to be a good decade for the Yates-Geldof family. A year after Bob starred as the lead protagonist in Pink Floyd's The Wall, and Paula recorded a not-so-memorable cover of These Boots Are Made for Walking, the couple welcomed their first of their 3 daughters, Fifi Trixie Belle. But it was in 1984 that things would dramatically change for the couple. 1984 is the year Bob would co-write the song, Do They Know It's Christmas, after he and Paula had seen a BBC special on the Ethiopian famine. Bob and Midge recorded the song with a newly formed supergroup called Band Aid that included Phil Collins, Boy George, George Michael, Sting, and Bono, to name a few. The song was one of the fastest-selling singles in UK history and was popular across the world. It raised £8 million for Ethiopian relief and made Bob a saint in the eyes of Brits. Side note, Do They Know It's Christmas hasn't aged super well due to its completely tone-deaf lyrics. Bob and Midge have tweaked the lyrics over the years, and they've continued to do subsequent recordings to raise funds. and Bob totally acknowledges that you created an awful song. Running on the success of Do They Know It's Christmas, Bob and Midge organized Live Aid, a global benefit concert for the Ethiopian famine. While the official Live Aid concert simultaneously broadcasted from Wembley Stadium in London and JFK Stadium in Philadelphia, concerts in various countries across the world also joined in. Side note, INXS performed in the Australian version. It's estimated that 40% of the world's population tuned into the coordinated shows. Freddie Mercury and Queen gave one of their most iconic performances of their career, and everyone from Madonna to Tom Petty, Bob Dylan, U2, David Bowie, and Led Zeppelin performed. Nothing like this had ever been done before, and it was considered a huge success. In total, it raised over $127 million for the Ethiopian famine, and some consider it a game changer in getting the general public to care about and donate to social causes in other parts of the world. However, it's been reported that some of the funds unintentionally fell into the hands of leaders and groups in Ethiopia who have misused the money. In response to Bob's selfless efforts, he was given honorary knighthood by the Queen of England in 1986. But because he is not a British citizen, he can never use the title of Sir. While Bob's star was rising, so was Paula's. By the mid-80s, she was the host of a popular music program called The Tube, which intertwined musical performances with interviews of rockers. It was in 1985 that Paula most likely met Michael Hutchence for the first time, where she briefly interviewed him for the program. If you watch the clip on YouTube, Paula introduces her interview by saying that Michael invited her back to his hotel room, but she responded with, "I'm sorry, Michael, but I've got a baby." In the interview itself, Paula Yates is chewing on her nails and twirling her earrings while talking to Michael. I watched other interviews she had conducted, and while she's a generally very flirty person, it's fair to say she's extra flirty with Michael. And Michael is flirty back. He too rubs his fingers along his lips. But he's also kind of generally flirty person as well. In their brief interview, Yates talks about how tight his trousers are and how he was voted the sexiest man in Australia. Many people in the Hutchence-Yates orbit, in particular Paula's one-time publicist and friend Jerry Agar, claimed the two began an affair years before they would publicly hook up in 1995. Jerry even said that 10 years before they would have their daughter, Tiger Lily, they had talked about having a child. 10 years earlier would be around the time of this Tube interview. Did they start seeing each other at this time? I haven't been able to confirm it, but what I do know is that Paula reportedly kept a picture of Michael on her family refrigerator with the words "love dog" written on it, and Bob reportedly degraded it. At one point, it is said that Paula told INXS's manager that she would, quote, "have that boy," and she would regularly attend their concerts. Paula and Bob eventually married in 1986 and would have two more daughters, Peaches in 1989 and Pixie in 1990. Paula had established herself as a sort of Madonna figure who was continually photographed with one, two, or three children on her hip, breast, or side. She even wrote a couple of books about parenting. From all accounts, she loved being a mom. By the early 90s, Paula was hosting The Big Breakfast, a variety show of sorts where Paula interviewed people in bed. Her husband was a producer of the show. Though the show was popular, this was an unhappy time for Paula in her marriage. She told friends that Bob was grumpy and controlling, and that he didn't contribute to the family, leaving her to do most of the work. Also, because of his life as a rock musician, their schedules barely lined up. It was in October 1994 that Paula would publicly meet up again with Michael, and their interview would literally make jaws drop. This is where I'm going to end part one of the Paula Yates and Michael Hutchence story. I hope you'll join me next week as we learn more about their short and tragic love affair. This episode was researched, written, and read by me, Lauren Modery. It was edited by Jonathan Luna and produced by Mike G, who also wrote the music. If you enjoy this podcast, please consider leaving us a review on Apple or wherever you listen to your podcasts.